I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. So almost anyone I talk to in the food world, if they know Mike Solomonov, they love Mike Solomonov. He's the chef of Zahav and a bunch of other restaurants in Philadelphia. He's got a new book out called Israeli Soul, but he's also one of these dudes who you just know could be the mayor of any town he lives in. You know what I mean? He's smart, he's funny, he's got a great vibe. And he was one of our favorite guests on the show this year, so we thought, how about we bring him back in for some story time and take a few calls together? So Mike, it is awesome to have you back in, brother.
Oh, dude, thank you so much for having me, and thanks for the kind words.
So I gotta say, I am really excited about your book, Israeli Soul.
Thank you.
And for one specific reason. I love the trim size. Yeah. I've just been needing a book that size to fit on my desk. No, the tahina shake.
Yes.
I'm obsessed with your tahina shake.
I appreciate that, man. We are very proud of the tahina shake, and I feel like the tahina shake is like the sort of like fuel that is carrying our like restaurant group right now. It's like so good. But it's simple, and it's essentially the tahina shake recipe that you can make with a blender.
Yeah.
In your house, you know?
Okay, so for folks who have never had a tahina shake, is it original to you? Is it a
thing? Is original to us. Okay. We opened a Goldie, which is our falafel shop, and we wanted it to actually be vegan without really calling it like a vegan, you know? Yeah. And so we had these like tahina milkshakes that are made with almond milk and tahina and like sugar. Yeah. You know, and they are awesome. They're very, very good. And we put them in Israeli Soul, which is our newish cookbook. And yeah, and you can now make it in the comfort of your own home. So you can be in your bathrobe, right? And drink it out of the... Like, I feel like the best smoothie or the best sort of milkshake is the one that you can drink out of the sort of top of the blender, you know, whilst, you know, watching TV in your underwear. And I feel like it tastes better that way. So now you can do that. And if you don't want to do that, you can just come into Goldie in your bathrobe and drink shakes that way. But we're really excited about the book. I mean, we really, you know, after Zahav was such a huge project and such an important project for us, and taking all the sort of the history and like my personal history and my family's history and all the different cuisines and sort of synthesizing them and having Zahav the restaurant sort of be this like conduit. Mm-hmm. What we did was took the whole team that worked on that and just like flew them. We just went to Israel and we shot film and ate for like 8 days.
Yeah.
And had like 82 meals and then came back from that and sort of put the book together based on like our experience. Yeah. So it's very, very different, really fun, really, really vibrant. And, you know, naming books is not the easiest thing to do sometimes.
And sometimes it's incredibly painful.
Exactly. So for Zahav, it made sense. We had a restaurant and that was like the way that we, sort of like introduced everybody to what it was that we were doing. Right. And with Israeli Soul, we were like, well, what do we don't want to call it like Israeli street food, you know? And we kept referring to the sort of soul of dining that we were doing, you know? And it wasn't like, it was like, how do you put vocabulary to the sort of marketplace, to the standing in kiosks at 2 o'clock in the morning, to the sort of tiny little restaurants that serve like one thing, to the tables like littered with like 10 different salad team and, you know, and what do we sort of call that? And we were just, the word Israeli Soul came up not as a title for the book, but like kind of to the method in which we were traveling through the country and eating. And then it just sort of stuck.
Yeah. So where do you find the most soul when you're eating in Israel?
So I think that it's hard to not find the most soul in people's homes. I think that when you eat in somebody's home, you realize that everybody, every person that makes up that household is from somewhere else, essentially. And with them, they've brought their, you know, their food from the diaspora or the food from the land. And the way that it all comes at this intersection on a table, as cliched as that sound, I mean, that's the way that it happens. So I feel like the most soul is in the house. But you see it in so many different ways, so many different varieties everywhere that you go. You cannot help but run into a plethora of cultures on the street, in bus stops, in restaurants, on the side of the road, you know, driving in the north in the Galilee and just having these people sort of making like mountain bread over a fire, you know?
Yeah.
You just can't help but run into it. So, but I do think that the best way to experience Israeli soul is in somebody's home.
How'd you get into people's houses? How'd you get into their homes?
It's a very surprisingly easy to do in Israel. I think you could just knock on somebody's door like before Shabbat and they'll probably bring you in. I've got a lot of family there, but people are super open and super welcoming, and hospitality in the truest form exists over there. It really does. And I think that, I don't know, why don't you come with us sometime, man? You would love it. You've told me you've never been lifted on a chair for a celebration. We could make that happen over there, you know?
Get off the plane, get on a chair.
Get off the plane, we'll put you on a chair right through customs. Yeah, that wouldn't raise an eyebrow. But then you could come to like my dad's house on Saturday afternoon, and it's Bulgarian, Romanian, Persian, Arabic, you know, it's everything. And that's what, there's nothing like that. There's nothing like seeing the way that certain individuals and family members or people that are at the table cling on to these things that are multi-generation, that represent who they are. The way that they cook that, the way that they handle the eggplant over the charcoal and gently peel the skin and mince up the flesh just right with just the right amount of garlic and salt to represent Romanian Jewry, right? There's just not, there's no way to like really describe that. So I think you have to come with me.
God, I'd love to see that. That'd be incredible. Well, thank you for the invitation. But okay, so this is totally different. And maybe it's just a morbid curiosity, but I have been...
Yes, I love the way that this question is being asked.
I've been sort of collecting disaster stories from some of the people I interview. We warned you about this, right?
You did warn me about that. What was my answer? I don't remember. I have so many of them. You know, the problem is that a lot of like the disasters are like, you know, things that you like try to block out and forget in restaurants. I'm trying to think of like what, I know what it was. The disaster story. You ready?
I'm ready.
You ready? Okay. So it was like probably my first time or one of the earlier times that I've done like live television. You know, these like morning shows, you have 2.5 minutes. And it's like not necessarily about the food, but you want to be super animated, right? And I was gonna Japanese mandolin celery.
Okay.
And that was kind of how I was gonna open it. And I think it was like maybe like a Passover thing or what. And I ended up in the first second, like they opened like, I'm here with Chef Michael Solomonov. And I wanted to be mandolining. And I sliced the tip of my thumb off.
Oh.
Like in the first second. And I had to grab like a side towel and cover my thumb, and then it was my right hand. I'm a righty, and I had to go through 3 minutes without indicating that I was like bleeding profusely from my thumb, and had my hand behind my back, and I was gripping a towel, and somehow turned the segment into like taste this, taste that, and then like rock, paper, scissors for like it was Passover. So there was like a big pile of like horseradish, right? Or the crane, the sort of beet pickled horseradish.
Yeah.
And I turned it into like, you know, who's gonna eat the, you know, the giant teaspoon of like or tablespoon of horseradish, and somehow got through 3 minutes without having to use my right hand or cook.
Yeah.
And that was cool.
a mouthful of horseradish. You're crying.
I was in shock because, you know, whenever the first, you know, mandolins are rough, dude. There's not
super sharp.
Everybody cuts their fingers. You never expect it to happen. And I remember making everybody in the restaurant afterwards later that night, watch it because it was like really disturbing if you knew what was happening. But I was impressed with that.
I'm impressed with you. I also like the fact that the entire time you were telling the story, you clenched your right hand into a fist and hit it under the table.
I had to.
You were just like reliving that moment.
I know. It hurt. I was like holding the bottom of my shirt, you know? Yeah, it totally, that was a situation.
Well, I'm sorry you had to experience that.
What's your disaster story?
Oh, dude. Oh, I have one for you, man. But actually, we have to go to a break, so hold on. We'll be back with that story, and Chef Mike Solomonoff is sticking around to take your calls. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. We've been spending this episode with the chef Mike Solomonoff of Zahav and author of the new book, Israeli Soul. Mike, we're back from the break.
I'm feeling refreshed, Francis. How about you?
I've never had more energy. All right, so I...
We should do this, like, all the time, you and I.
Let's take it on the road. All right, yeah. So I promised you my disaster story. And, okay, it was my last night in culinary school. Like, literally the very last night. We were graduating the next day.
Mm-hmm. And you went to FCI or no?
I went to CIA.
Okay.
The Culinary Institute of America. We have a school song.
Do you really?
Yeah. I'm not going to sing it for you.
Disaster stories.
It was the last night of school, and we were graduating the next morning at like some ungodly hour in the morning, like, you know, commencement at 7:45, right. You know, something totally, I think, meant to keep us safe for the night.
Yeah.
You know, what it also just meant was everyone was showing up still drunk from the night before.
Yeah, or stay awake.
Yeah. But I was excited and I was like, you know, emotional, had a really good time. You know, all these kids I've been in school with for 2 years, you know, you want to remember the night. And I was also, not to brag, but I was like our class speaker for the next day. So I was like thinking about that, what am I going to say? And the last class I had in cooking school was in the front of the house. So the last like however months of our program, you had to like work in our school restaurants, either in the front or the back, and you switch. So whatever, like I happened to have a shift as a server as my very last night of culinary school. And we were in our classic old school French restaurant. And one of the things that we got to do in the front of the house was tableside service, which I loved.
Of course.
Because you get to be a ham in front of like, people, and they're so psyched, and you know, whatever. You just got to be a
clown.
You
literally light like a waffle on fire, and they think it's like the most brilliant thing ever.
Yeah. Three stars.
Yeah.
Exactly. That was totally my vibe, right? Yeah. And so we were serving. We had been serving bananas Foster, bananas flambé on our tableside dessert for a couple of weeks. I love doing it. They taught me this really cool technique where you can pick up the banana, and it's very sanitary because you cut off the top of it and then you insert a fork into the skin and you roll the skin down so you never touch the banana flesh.
Unbelievable.
Wows people.
Yeah.
Then you've got your little burner, you've got your butter and your brown sugar, and you're slicing the banana still in the skin to fall into the pan,
right.
Caramelizing it. You get the rum, flames, you pour it over. People love it.
They go crazy.
Yeah. So I am loving it because they're loving it.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, like the last day of class, they switch out the menu and it's not a Bananas Foster, which we've been doing for 3 straight weeks.
Yeah.
But now it's Cherry's Jubilee.
Mm.
Which is a fine dessert.
Yeah.
Except for the fact that we graduated on November like 29th or whatever it was.
Cherry Jubilee is like no Banana Foster.
It's no Bananas Foster. There's no cool cutting technique. And here's the deal. I pick up the ramekin of cherries and I drop it into the pan.
Oh, and it catches on fire?
No, it goes clunk because they're frozen.
No.
Frozen cherries because it's November.
That's whack.
It's not cool.
Yeah.
It is not cool. So I'm like really bummed out that the guests are like not as excited. They're like, oh, they're frozen. I mean, I totally pulled some bowl out of my back pocket and was like, Oh, yes, of course, because, you know, we had these beautiful cherries in June, and so we had to preserve them all year round so our guests could enjoy them. We flash froze them immediately.
Flash froze.
Yeah,
yeah, right.
I think we got them out of a bag.
I know, because we have a flash freezer here. Yeah, in the back. That's also the magic of front of the house, is to just basically lie through your teeth.
Absolutely.
Say whatever.
So anyway, so I'm like making the Cherries Jubilee all night long. I was like, okay, cool. But here comes the last table. And it's like 11:59 at night. You know, we're going to turn to pumpkins.
Yeah.
So I'm like, you know what? I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this for them. And the really cool thing about Cherries Jubilee is you're burning kirsch instead mm-hmm. of rum. And kirsch burns super blue. Mm-hmm. Like when you set kirsch, it's a crazy...
It's a crazy color.
Otherworld yeah. cobalt blue with the red cherries. It looks really yeah. amazing. So I'm like, okay, here we go. Got the pan. I've got the cherries. Plunk! Mm-hmm. They're softening up in the butter.
Yeah.
And I'm supposed to give like a three count of kirsch. And I'm like, 1, 2, 3... 4, 5, 6,
this is never a good,
7.
Never a good thing.
I'm like, I'm going to do this. I tip that pan into the flame.
Yeah.
And the next thing I remember is a fireball. like a fireball coming to end creation
yeah.
right at my face.
Oh my God.
And I remember ducking, but I remember not knowing if I ducked enough.
Oh.
And I look up afterwards and I look around the room. And all of my fellow students who had been so emotional about leaving
yeah.
are doubled over yeah. laughing. And like my teacher is like wiping tears from his eyes.
Oh, man.
And he just comes over after I'm done serving and he puts his hand on my shoulders. You should go to the bathroom right now.
Wow.
And all I think is, dear God, let me have eyebrows.
Yeah. Did you get burned?
I still have my eyebrows.
Yeah.
But I had like sort of like vaguely Greasy spiky hair at the time. And definitely like a quarter of my hair was not the same length as the other of my hair.
You know, what I've learned is that kirsch flames don't like hair product. or they love hair products, you know? Oh my gosh. First of all, that's amazing. And I'm so happy that like nobody got injured.
Thank you.
How was your speech?
Went off okay.
Good.
I got emotional.
Good. You know what you should do? It's like if you're ever like tanking in a speech, you just put kirsch in a pan and light it on fire and run off stage.
So with that, you want to take some calls with me? I am so excited for this.
Yes, let's hear it.
Let's
hear
it
from our people.
We have Matthew on from Athens, Ohio. Hey, Matthew, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. So you're on with me and my friend Mike Solomonoff.
Hey, Matthew.
Hello, Mike. How are you?
I'm good.
All right. What should we talk about?
Well, I want to talk about eggplant, more specifically in the context of moussaka. And can I give you a little history?
Yeah,
love history.
Well, way back in my college days, there was a little diner owned by a Greek couple about a half block from the campus gate, and I discovered the all-encompassing joy of moussaka. And I treated myself to that pretty regularly all through college. And then after college, and I'd met the person I was going to spend my life with, I thought I'd learn to make it on my own. Found a good basic recipe, and the lamb was terrific, and the bechamel topping was terrific. But I could never get my eggplant to the texture of the eggplant in the moussaka that I had discovered at this diner. My eggplant always came out kind of mushy, maybe oily, maybe watery. And my first encounter with eggplant in moussaka was that it was sort of tender and buttery and sort of a bread-like texture.
Huh.
And I wonder if you know what I'm talking about and if you can give me any idea for a cooking technique that'll get me that kind of a texture. I've tried roasting, I've tried grilling, I've tried frying. I even saw a recipe where you put a heavy pan on top of it while you're pan roasting it. And I'm never happy with the results.
Right. Well, Matthew, I understand your pain. I mean, eggplant is a really finicky thing. And I was just talking to my partner, Steve Cook, and who was in Israel recently. And he was like, I'm not sure what it is, but the eggplant in Israel needs very little. Like you don't, you know, here in the States, the practice in restaurants and even in the home is to treat the eggplant. You always have to slice it, salt it, press it, drain it, sometimes rinse it. You know, we brine our eggplant. It's a huff. But I think that I would try two things. What I would do is slice the eggplant thin
and and brush it with salt. Let it hang out for about a half an hour in a colander and try to squeeze a little bit of the water out of it. And then from that point, what you can do is brush it with olive oil and roast it. So it mimics the sort of like lasagna sheets. But if you want it really tender, I mean, the weird thing is that if you just sort of like pack it in there with the meat and the bechamel and bake it, provided that the eggplant is sort of fresh, it will roast and get creamy in there. It'll sort of steam and roast. I prefer the two-part cooking method when it comes to moussaka. I really like the sear or the sauté and then the bake. I find that to be better. But if you want the sort of creamy, sort of luscious quality that the eggplant has, I would salt it, squeeze it, and then just sort of pack it in there with the meat and bechamel.
Okay.
Right on. And does the type of eggplant matter?
It does. The problem is that you're not going to be able to find, you're sort of at the whim of like the grocery store in which you buy the eggplant.
Sure.
You know? So water content, seed content, and sort of the composition of fiber really depends on like factors that we have no control over, unfortunately. And season as well. And you're in Ohio, is that right?
Yes, in Ohio.
I mean, so you're getting California or like Mexican eggplant most of the year.
Well, we have a really good farmer's market here. And if there's a variety of eggplant I should be looking for, I could pass around.
I think that like the Italian eggplant is kind of what you want. You're not getting eggplant though, you know, from now till June, right? I mean, it's not going to be local.
It's going to be a grocery store, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So I would just get comfortable with that. And then, you know, I would concern myself with the thickness and the sort of curing of it with the salt. And I would sort of play around with those methods.
And that searing, would you say at a high temperature, a medium temperature?
I would say high temperature for a very short period of time.
Okay.
Yeah, and I understand your love for moussaka. It's really one of my favorite things. My grandmother was Sephardic Bulgarian, so they spent a lot of their time sort of with Ottoman influence in their cooking, and they didn't keep kosher. So we always had good moussaka, and I think it is a really special thing.
Well, I do too. I love it. I used to make it about once a year, usually around Easter or around my birthday in April, because I think of lamb as a spring thing.
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely. But I feel like when it gets cold out, it justifies you eating like these like 4,000 calorie slices of moussaka. And oh my God, cold for breakfast is like the best thing ever.
Really? I don't think I've ever eaten it cold.
Yeah, I mean, that's like an American thing. that's not very traditional. Do you put cinnamon in your bechamel?
Yes. Oh, well, I put cinnamon in the ground lamb, and then I top it with a little more cinnamon on the bechamel. Yeah.
Very important. Good. Good to hear.
Sweet. Yeah.
Seal of approval.
I'll give it a try.
Give it a shot, Matthew. Let us know how it goes.
I will.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you very much for taking me.
It's great to talk with you.
See you.
That was great. I have absolutely nothing to add to that.
That's not, you can just chill.
This is great.
I like it when people get really sort of intrigued by like ethnic food, you know? And they get... I know people that... you know, they grew up in the States. They had a roommate that was like from Greece or from Turkey. They taught them how to stretch phyllo in their college dorm, and they make like fresh baklava like all the time. I think
that's
so
awesome.
Cool. Yeah.
All right. So we are taking your calls. I'm with my friend, Mike Salamov, the chef of Zahav and the author of Israeli Soul. And, Mike, we just talked about eggplants. How many eggplants do you go through in your restaurants in like a week?
There's not a number for the amount. It's infinite. We go through so much eggplant. We probably go through, I don't know, anywhere between 2 and 3 cases a day.
In just Zahav?
Yeah, in just Zahav.
What do you do with them?
Everything. Everything. We grill, we roast, we've got the sort of like eggplant salad that's twice cooked. We do kind of like a baba ganoush. But honestly, eggplant, we will split an eggplant, brine it in like salt water, and then grill it as like an entree.
Oh, cool.
With Trina. Yeah, and people, it's probably one of our most popular entrees, and it happens to be vegan.
Cool. So we are going to go to our next caller. We have Kate calling in from Wake, Virginia. Hey, Kate.
Hi, Francis. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. You're on with me and also my friend Mike Salamanov.
Hey, Kate.
How exciting. How are you? It's so nice to speak with you both.
Well, thank you. And what should we speak about?
Let's see. My husband works at a local boarding school, and it's an international school. So he has a small group of students who are coming to dinner. And two of the students are from China, so obviously far from home. And they asked for me to make them ramen, which I said, sure, okay, I'll do. And without having ever made it before. And then, you know, I get looking at recipes and started panicking a little bit as the broth in and of itself is quite a gesture of love to give to anybody. So, okay, so I'm panicking a little bit. I've got a weekend. I live in very rural Virginia, so getting, you know, seaweed is going to be a challenge, but I have time to get down to a city to, you know, I can get the stuff. If you could help me get organized and get my brain around what actually has to happen to have it be good, authentic ramen for these kids so far from home.
Okay, so this is actually a really big question. I don't know if I can answer every possible scenario.
Right.
One thing is that ramen is traditionally, the word ramen, although it has origins in Chinese food, it actually is a transliteration from basically lo mein, but it's Japanese. And so if they're saying ramen, I'm wondering if they're actually referring to the Japanese dish ramen,
which is
not actually, you know, the Chinese noodle. So I wonder if, I mean, they might actually mean they want instant ramen, because I don't know where they're.
I mean, that's what the American kids are expecting.
I don't know, because I grew up, I ate so much instant ramen when I was a kid, and it was like
totally
a thing in our family. Yeah, totally. And there are like Chinese versions of it and with Chinese flavors, but
the Korean versions of ramen, like the shin bowl, is like one of my favorite things to eat.
Unbelievable.
It's good. It's 104% of your daily sodium allowance, but it is amazing.
Okay.
It is amazing.
And super spicy. Yeah, like Shin Ramyun is
the
Korean brand. S-H-I-N R-A-M-Y Ramyun. R-A-M-Y-O-N.
Okay.
Yeah. It's my favorite, and I can't tell if it's the chilies or if it's the salt burning your esophagus that make it so good, but it is so good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's a super delicious one. Mm-hmm. I hate the idea of like sending you down the wrong road.
I think it's a really tricky thing to do, because I think that, first of all, like I find I'm like unclear about what it is that these students actually want. Secondly, I think having to recreate anything authentic in air quotes, like not in the right context, is an impossible thing to do, you know?
Right.
And I think that also in, you know, like in rural Virginia, trying to find ingredients that that may be even close to what it is that you're going to, I would go a different route.
Okay.
I would make
Burger
like
bar
chicken
it
noodle.
Is.
I would make like chicken noodle soup. You know, if you want to, when you sort of alkalize the noodles, have you done that recently where you basically add like baking soda to like boiling pasta and it sort of ramenizes?
Oh,
them?
Really?
Wow.
I've never done that.
It's the easiest. No. It's literally adding like X amount of baking soda and sometimes salt to water the Ideas in Food people, Alexander Talbot, does an amazing sort of version of ramen noodles where it is like spaghetti or something that is super basic. I can't remember. But if you check it out, just Google Ideas in Food and like ramenized noodles or whatever, you'll see it. And it's like adding spaghetti or linguine to water that has got like baking soda in it, and it makes the noodles ramen-esque.
That gives them that like chewy texture.
Exactly. Very awesome.
Very good.
My kids, I have a 4 and a 7-year-old that are like the pickiest eaters in the world. For some reason, they love Asian noodle soup. That's like one of the four things. And so for me to get them to eat like chicken noodle soup, I have to treat noodles this way.
That's so
because it's reminiscent of like ramen, you know, and that's like what they trust. So I would make, what's your favorite soup? What's the iconic soup that you make like for yourself or what you,
Oh, yeah. I love making soup. I just love a really good chicken stock with some Asian noodles. And, you know, we fry the garlic in the oil and it gets all kind of crunchy and toasty and a lot of cilantro and a handful of, you know, this and that. And
it sounds like something that we want here in this in the studio. And it's probably what the students want.
Yeah, I think they'll be pretty psyched about that. Yeah, look at that noodle treatment.
Yeah.
That ramenized noodle treatment. Or, you know, serve them something like Mike said that you feel comfortable making, that you're happy to make, that you're happy to eat, and welcome them into your home and into your world.
That's what I'll do. That's exactly what I'll do. Thank you so much, both of you, for your help.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye.
All right. Take care.
You could go for some soup, some noodle soup right now. You know?
Totally.
You should check out this method, though. It's really cool.
That's so I've never heard of that. That's incredible.
Yeah, that's awesome.
We'll be back in a minute with more of your calls with our friend Mike Solomonoff. And then America's Test Kitchen tells us about some flavor disasters that are on purpose.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Oh, Lord. Well, it's not peach.
It's not peach.
I can tell you that much. I'm getting like a garbagey flavor. Why am I still
chewing this?
There they are, getting into the worst jelly beans on earth. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. We've been spending the hour with Mike Solomonoff. You may know him from such hits as Zahav and Federal Donuts, or from his new book, Israeli Soul. Mike, it's fun to have you taking calls with me. We've never done this before.
I know. I feel like we should be doing this all the time. And I'm excited that you got my last name correctly. And I'm excited to hear from more of our people. Let's bring it.
All right, let's do it. We have Rachel from Minneapolis, home base.
Yeah, thanks so much for taking my question.
It's a pleasure to talk with you.
So my question is about a technique. I've recently gotten into black garlic. I love it on everything. And I realized I can make it in my rice cooker using my warming setting. For me, it's about 2 weeks until the garlic's ready. And I've been making a lot of it. And I thought to myself, what else can I make using this technique? So I thought I'd ask you if there's something else I can be doing in my rice cooker, similar to how I'm making black garlic.
This is a great question. I have never made black garlic. I have to say, though, this is super funny timing because I just this morning was talking to Rene Redzepi, and he has a book called The Noma Guide to Fermentation, which is an incredible book. And there's a whole chapter on black garlic and black other things. So the very simple answer is, go buy the book because they have spent
the really simple answer is other things.
They have spent all the hours and all the time and all of like the terrible things to blacken to find all the delicious ones. But reading through that chapter, I remember you can make shallots the same way you would make black garlic. So black garlic, for listeners who don't know about it, is basically garlic that has been left to, I guess not technically ferment, but sort of like cook itself or have like this intense enzyme reaction where if you basically leave the garlic hanging out in 140 degree room or in a rice cooker set on the warm setting for a few weeks or even a month, the garlic comes out and it looks black. Like the garlic cloves all look super black. They're kind of soft, they're kind of taffy-like, and they have this intense, delicious umami, garlic, soy sauce.
Sweet, too.
Sweet
caramel
flavor.
Yeah,
it's like a incredible caramelized garlic. It's like roasted garlic times 1,000.
Yeah.
And you can just like spread it on a piece of roast chicken, or you can mix it with butter, and you can do all these crazy, awesome, delicious things with it once you have that thing. So you can use that same method for shallots and make black shallots, which is like the caramelized onion version of this like caramelized garlic vibe.
I am doing that.
And they also have all these methods for doing like black apples, which sounds incredible. Black chestnuts.
I wonder if you could do like black citrus. Like we use black limes a lot with sort of Persian cooking.
Yeah.
Where you dry out citrus. And I'm wondering if it would do sort of the same thing.
Yeah. Do you know how black limes are made?
I mean, like, you in the sun? Just, you literally put them, no, you could do them in sun or you could do them like low temperature above an oven for a very long time. But I would imagine it wouldn't be that far off. And black limes are really good. Black garlic is amazing. I also love, Francis, how you started the conversation by saying, I was on the phone with Renee Redzepi earlier today. You've been waiting all day to say that. Like, it was like you were in the elevator on the way to the office and you were like to some stranger, I was on the phone with Renee Redzepi.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, when Michelle Obama and I were hanging out. All right, Rachel, so have fun blackening things. And like, I mean, I would definitely look at that book. Or you can just experiment and know that some experiments go well and some will make you regret it.
I've been hesitant to experiment because I'm concerned about food safety. And I'm not a trained chef. So I thought I'd come to the people who know what they're doing. Do you know, Francis, if this technique has a name?
Oh, I just know it as black. Well, black and I don't know.
I don't think so because I feel like black garlic is kind of, was
its own
up
thing.
Until recently kind of its own thing.
Yeah,
like a low temp, long term fermentation. I feel like we should have a name.
That's a really beautiful acronym.
Long term
fermentation. Lutf.
Yeah, exactly.
Lutf.
That sounds actually pretty Nordic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which works in Minnesota.
Yeah, of course.
Cool. Have fun blackening things.
Good luck with everything. Thank you.
I will. I'll check out that book. Thanks for the recommendation.
Right on. Take care. All right. We have Katie from St. Louis. Hey, how are you, Katie?
Good. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. You are on with my friend Mike Solomonov. He's the chef of Zahav. And what would you like to talk about?
Yeah. So I have started making homemade Greek yogurt. And every time that I do it, I use like a gallon of milk and I end up getting about a quart of acidic whey left over. So I was wondering, what can I do with all of this whey that I have? I have been putting some on my like acid living plants, like my rose bushes and azaleas, but they can only take so much.
They can only take so much. Hey, Katie, this is Mike. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. So we make labneh, we make yogurt and all that at Zahav. We always have leftover. We brine vegetables in it and it is awesome, so good. We also, you can poach things like potatoes and stuff in there, and it, you can add it to I don't know if you make ice cream, but it helps sometimes smooth out ice cream bases. And honestly, like, I use it for smoothies, fruit smoothies, because it's got all types of good stuff in there. So I would say that.
Tell me about brining vegetables and whey.
So it's really, it's cool because you've got acidity, and depending on the salt content of what it is that you're making, you've got a little bit of salt in there, but you can always add like salt and honey to this whey, and then you could drop like eggplant, zucchini, green vegetables, things that you like to roast, you know.
Yeah.
And it's awesome. Also, if you get some tomatoes that are a little bit underripe, I like to score them a little bit and drop them in the whey for like 25 minutes. And they're just like delicious. Really, really tasty.
Oh, it just like pulls in that little bit of tang.
Exactly. And it's kind of what you want. I mean, think about, it's sort of like this like yogurty consomme, right? So, I mean, the things that you, like cooking oatmeal with it, delicious. Like there's, if you think about sometimes what you want out of yogurt, but you can't like mess with because of the cooking of it.
Oh, yeah.
It works in those applications. Cooking grains in it too. So good. Good. And if you wanted to like stew meat or like braised, like a veal breast or that kind of thing, it would also work nicely.
Yeah.
I feel like there was that sort of time in, I guess, the early 2000s where like Michel Bra came out. You know, he's the chef from the Abrac region in France. And he started using whey to like poach like lobsters and stuff like that. And it really sort of, it implies the sort of like milk fat and it implies acidity without really having too much of any of it, you know? So in the same way that buttermilk is really used as this sort of like crutch to a lot of different things, the yogurt whey does the same thing. But yogurt whey, I mean, it has like tons of protein in it. It's got really good stuff in it as well. So I definitely think even with like stone fruit and sort of summer berries, that sort of thing, it works really nicely.
Super cool.
Awesome. Yeah, I'll have to give that a try.
Oh, yeah. Mm. Also, if you like granitas, too.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I think you add a bit of sugar. Like, I don't know if I'd use honey necessarily. That would conflict with the texture. But, you know, take a little bit of, like, you know, flax and a little bit of, like, agave or some natural sugar. Mix it up with the whey. Put it in the freezer. And every 30 minutes until it's totally frozen, take it out and shred it up with a fork. And you've got something really fresh that you can kind of, like, dump on melons for breakfast.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a good idea.
That sounds super great. Also, like, weirdly awesome. Healthy.
Yeah.
Like, when you start throwing in flax, I'm like, oh, that's going to make you live forever.
It flax is, I know, it is good stuff, but flax has got good texture in the right application, yeah. too.
I love toasted flax seeds.
Toasted flax seeds are awesome, and they're sort of gummy, but they also are really nice and crisp, and flax is tremendously healthy.
Cool. I hope you got some ideas, Katie.
Yeah,
let us know thanks how it goes. So much for the info. I'll have to give those a try.
Great. See ya.
Happy yogurt making.
All right, thanks, everyone.
All right, thanks, bye. After you brine the vegetables in whey, do you cook them or do you like pickle them in the whey?
No. I like to brine them in the whey and then yank them out and like grill them. You know, I think it's really nice. Or roasting is really good too.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's good. I'm trying to think of what else I would cook with whey. Like, I feel like potatoes would make a lot of sense. You know, when you do like the brandade sort of thing and you go like potatoes uber savory with like anchovies or salt cod, you know, typically you take the salt cod and you cook it in like milk, but what if it was like potatoes, whey, garlic, anchovy? I think it would make a lot of sense, you know?
Oh, that'd be cool. I want to go try that. Cook potatoes in whey and then whip them. Mike, it's been awesome hanging with you today, man.
It has been so fun hanging out with you. We got to do this again. Thank you so much for having me on. It's such a pleasure catching up, bro.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. Happy New Year to you.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you.
Mike Solomonov's new book is called Israeli Soul, and he left us with his recipe for that awesome tahina shake. You can find it at splendidtable.org. Okay, so I kind of alluded to it earlier, but for whatever reason, the last few months, I have been slightly obsessed with collecting people's food disaster stories. And I don't exactly know why. Maybe it's just something in the air. It's like the times we live in. But I'm going to keep collecting them. And in the meantime, America's Test Kitchen told us about an episode of their new podcast, Proof, where they took a look at what happens when flavor disasters happen on purpose. Producer Sarah Joyner spent months reporting on a story about the worst jelly beans ever.
Jelly Belly Candy Company is in the business of making bad flavored beans. I came across a product they have. It's called Bean Boozled, and I became completely fixated on it. I know that sounds strange, but stick with me. It's a bag full of jelly beans with a bunch of colors all mixed together. It's sort of roulette for your taste buds. Each color could be a good flavor or a really horrible one. And the horrible ones, they're really bad. They taste exactly as billed. Dead fish, rotten egg, stinky socks. It's like you're actually eating those things. So my curiosity got the best of me. I spent months investigating, all with the hope of figuring out how. What's in these bad flavored beans, and how in the world do they make them? First, I turned to my colleagues. As test cooks at America's Test Kitchen, they're skilled at tasting, at sort of parsing out the components of food and coming up with recipes. So, I convinced an unlucky few to help me in my endeavors.
Oh my goodness. Okay, well, on the back we have a 5x4 grid of different jelly beans.
Okay.
Some are good.
Okay.
And some of them are terrible. Canned dog food, no. Moldy cheese, stinky socks.
Let's do these.
Okay.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Oh, Lord. Well, it's not peach.
It's not peach.
I can tell you that much. I'm getting like a garbagey flavor. Why am I still chewing
crying.
This? This is offensive. I'm offended.
Is it vomit? It's vomit, right?
We'll see. Yeah, it's barf. That's a barf-flavored jelly bean we both just ate.
I would not even begin to be able to guess how they got away with doing that.
All
I mean,
right.
Just like, what even is vomit? I mean, I don't know. I don't even know. Do they just have like a closet at Jelly Belly where everything is terrible? I'm genuinely curious. I would love to know.
Yeah, does it start as a flavor reject? It was supposed to be good, and then it starts a little bit bad, and then they just roll with it and make it all the way bad.
Like, no, this one tastes like barf, and somebody's there with a clipboard like, okay, actually, put a pin in that. Yeah.
It was actually an interesting theory. Are Bean Boozled beans simply born out of a series of jelly bean recipe accidents? It turns out, not exactly. I caught up with Irena Miles. She's the head of development and regulatory at Jelly Belly, and she gave me a little more insight on Jelly Belly's process.
Well, you know, when we arrive to work, a lot of us start work before the actual manufacturing people start working. And so you come to work and everything's going well, and then all of a sudden the smells start entering your office, and you realize just what kind of day you're going to have.
Creating these bad flavors is a very hazardous gig that creates a few logistical problems. The bad flavors are accomplished by blending artificial and natural flavors. So they mix these flavors, combine it with a jelly bean base, and then they do something called panning, where the beans tumble in these large barrels with the coating to build up a shell. The flavor ingredients they're using are aromatic molecules, so they smell horrible. Jelly Belly has to take those horrible smells into consideration when they plan where in the plant the beans are actually going to be made. They can, at times, interfere.
Well, we also try to manufacture the bad beans on second shift. So if at all possible, we'll do it in the afternoon and into the evening. But that's not always possible, especially when we're making literally tons of these flavors. We can't do them all at night. In fact, we have built a small room inside our production area where we try to manufacture most of these beans so that the aromas don't go up into the air and get in the way of our tours.
Which is to say, the smells are so awful, the production is literally quarantined.
One of our favorite ones, which there's a bean, and I can't tell you what flavor it is, but it smells like cat pee. And there are people who have a very difficult time on that day.
Difficult might be a euphemism.
It is a challenge, and we were thinking about hazard pay, but we haven't convinced them just yet.
I never thought that I would hear hazard pay in the context of a conversation about jelly beans.
This manufacturing process of bad-flavored beans is brutal, but the steps that come before that, the recipe development, might be just as bad. In order to figure out the recipe for a bad flavor, the Jelly Belly chemists need to put themselves in some compromising situations in order to get inspired.
Well, a lot of times we try to find the object that we're trying to emulate. So in the case of stinky socks or sweaty feet, we'll ask people to bring in, you know, their tennis shoes, or we'll get their socks slightly moist and we'll put them in a Ziploc bag and let them ferment for a little while, and then we'll start understanding what it is that we're looking for, and then we start working with flavors to get all those tones and high notes in there as well.
But not every bad flavor has the same development story. It turns out some are not as intentional as others.
Years ago, we were tasked with making a pizza flavor bean, and we did a pretty good job, but it just wasn't good enough to be sold on the market. It tasted like a pizza, but there was a couple of things missing. So then a couple of years later, they said, you know, let's make a vomit bean. And a couple of people turned around and looked at each other and said, I think that they mean our pizza bean. So we pulled it out of the archives and we tasted it again, and it was pretty close to vomit. And then we realized this is why we didn't sell it as a pizza bean. There was a couple of things we tweaked about it, but it was pretty much a pizza bean.
So it seems my America's Test Kitchen colleagues' intuitions about how they create these bad flavors were actually pretty spot on. Some of them start as failed flavors that get new life as foul-tasting jelly beans. And I think there's a sort of absurdist poetry in this anecdote that a failed pizza bean can become a successful vomit bean. And there's a lesson here that applies to home cooks too.
Sometimes our biggest kitchen failures lead to the most novel discoveries. Some disasters are so bad, they are good.
Sarah Joyner is a producer for Proof, a podcast from America's Test Kitchen. And that is our show for the week. Thanks so much for listening. If you'd like more on anything you heard here today, go to splendidtable.org. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. Our production team includes senior producer Jennifer Russell. Jenny Lubke is our editor and technical director. Erica Romero is our associate producer. Chip Walton is our digital producer. And Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.